I said, as if I were surprised she'd asked such a stupid question. From the way she stiffened, she was as easy to get a rise out of as Adam. What are you worried about? It's no skin off your nose if the police do a little more work. Do you think a fey in the hand is better than searching the reservation for the guilty one? Her face tightened, and magic swelled in the air. It was searching the reservation that she was here to prevent, I thought. She wanted a quick execution. Maybe Z was supposed to hang himself and save everyone the publicity of a trial and the inconvenience of an investigation that put intruders' noses into the reservation. She was here to make sure there were no screw-ups. Like me. I considered her, and then turned to Tony. Did you put Z on a suicide watch? Fey don't do well in iron cages. He shook his head while Dr. Altman's mouth tightened.
Dr. Altman said that as a gremlin, Mr. Adalbert Smiter would be fine with the metal. But if you think I ought to, I will.
Please, I said. I'm very concerned. It wouldn't be foolproof, but it would make it harder to kill him. Tony's eyes were sharp as they looked from me to Dr. Altman. He was too good a cop not to notice the undercurrents between the two of us. He probably even knew it wasn't suicide I was worried about.
"Didn't you tell me you had some questions to ask Mercedes, Dr. Altman?"
he suggested with deceptive mildness. "Of course," she said. "The police here seem to respect your opinion about the Fey, but they don't know what your credentials are, other than the fact you once worked with Mr. Adalbert Smiter." Ah, an attempt to discredit me. If she'd expected to fluster me, she didn't know me very well. Any female mechanic knows how to respond to that kind of attack. I gave her a genial smile. "I've a degree in history, and I read Dr. Altman. For instance, I know that there was no such thing as a gremlin until Z decided to call himself one. If you'd excuse me, I'd better get back to work. I promised that this car would be finished today." I turned to do just that, and tripped on a stick that was lying on the ground. Tony was there with a hand under my elbow to help me back to my feet.
"Did you twist an ankle?" he asked.
"No, I'm fine," I told him, frowning at the fey walking stick that had appeared on the floor of my garage. "You'd better let go or you'll get covered with grease."
"I'm fine. A little dirt just impresses the rookies."
"What happened?" Dr. Altman asked, as if her blindness was something that would keep her from knowing what was happening around her, which I was certain it did not. I noticed that her dog was staring intently at the stick. Maybe she really did use it to help her see.
"She tripped on a walking stick."
Tony, who disengaged himself from Dr. Altman to catch me when I'd stumbled, bent down, picked it up, and put the stick down on my counter.
"This is pretty cool workmanship, Mercy. What are you doing with an antique walking stick on the floor of your garage?"
"Darned if I knew." "It's not mine. Someone left it at the shop. I've been trying to give it back to its rightful owner." Tony looked at it again.
"It looks pretty old. The owner should be happy to get it back."
There was a question in his voice. I don't think Dr. Altman heard it. I don't know how sensitive Tony is to magic, but he was quick, and his fingers lingered on the Celtic designs on the silver. I met his eyes and gave him a brief nod. Otherwise, he'd pick at it until even the blind Fay noticed he'd seen more than he ought. "You'd think so," I said ruefully. "But here it is." He smiled thoughtfully.
"If Dr. Altman is through, we'll just get out of your way," he said. "I'm sorry Z is unhappy with the way you chose to defend him, but I'll see to it he doesn't get railroaded."
"Or killed." "Take care," I told him seriously. "Don't do anything stupid." He raised an eyebrow.
"I'm as careful as you are."
I smiled at him and went back to work. No matter what I'd told its owner, this car wasn't going to be done until tomorrow. I buttoned it up, then cleaned up and checked my phone. I'd actually missed two calls. The second one was from Tony before he'd brought the department's Fay consultant. The first one was a number I didn't know with a long-distance area code. When I dialed it, Z's son Tad answered the phone. Tad had been my first tool rustler, but then he'd gone on to college and deserted me, just as Gabriel would do in a year or two. He'd actually been the one to hire me. He'd been working alone when I'd come needing a belt for my rabbit, having just blown an interview at Pasco High.
They wanted a coach, and I thought they should be more concerned that their history teachers could teach history, and I'd helped him out with a customer. I think he'd been 9 years old. His mother had just passed away, and Z wasn't dealing well with it. Tad had had to rehire me 3 more times in the next month before Z resigned himself to me, a woman and, he thought at first, a human.
Mercy, where have you been? I've been trying to get you since Saturday morning.
He didn't give me a chance to answer.
Uncle Mike told me that Dad had been arrested for murder. All I could get out of him was that it was related to the deaths on the reservation, and that I was, under the Grey Lord's edict, to stay where I am.
Tad and I share a certain disregard and distaste for authority. He probably had a plane ticket in his hand. Don't come, I said after a moment's fierce thought. The Grey Lords wanted someone guilty, and they didn't care who it was. They wanted a quick end to this mess, and anyone who stood between them and what they wanted would be in danger.
What the hell happened? I can't find out anything.
I heard in his voice the frustration I was feeling, too. I told him as much as I knew, from when Z asked me to sniff out the murderer to the blind woman who had just come with Tony, including Z's unhappiness with me because I had told the police and his lawyer too much. My gaze fell on the walking stick, so I added it into the mix.
It was a human killing the Fae? Wait a minute. The guard who was killed, this O'Donnell, was he a swarthy man, about 5'10 or thereabouts? His first name was Thomas?
That's what he looked like. I don't know what his first name was.
I told her that she was playing with fire, Tad said. Damn it. She thought it was funny because he thought he was doing her such a favor and she was just stringing him along. He amused her.
She who? I asked.
Connera, the reservation's librarian. She didn't like humans much and O'Donnell was a real turkey. She liked playing with them.
He killed her because she was playing games? I asked. Why'd he kill the others?
That's why they quit looking at him as the killer. He had no connection to the second guy murdered. Besides, Connera didn't have much magic. A human could have killed her. But Hendrick...
Hendrick?
The guy with the forest in his backyard. He was one of the hunters. His death pretty much eliminated all the human suspects. He was pretty tough.
There was a crashing sound.
Sorry, stupid corded phone. I pulled it off the table. Wait a minute. A walking stick, huh? It just keeps showing up?
That's right.
Can you describe it to me?
It's about 4 feet long, made of some sort of twisty wood with a gray finish. It's got a ring of silver on the bottom and a silver cap with Celtic designs on the top. I can't think why someone would keep bringing it back to me.
I don't think anyone is bringing it to you. I think it is following you around on its own.
What?
Some of the older things develop a few quirks. Power begets power and all that. Some of the things made when our power was more than it is now, they can become a little unpredictable, do things they weren't meant to.
Like follow me around. Do you think it followed O'Donnell to his house?
No. Oh, no. I don't think it did that at all. The walking stick was created to be of use to humans who help the Fae. It's probably following you around because you are trying to help Dad when everyone else has their fingers up their noses.
So O'Donnell stole it.
Mercy.
There was a choking sound.
Damn it, Mercy. I can't tell you. I'm forbidden. A Gaius, Uncle Mike said, for the protection of the Fae. Of me and of you.
It has something to do with your father's situation?
I thought.
With the walking stick, were other things stolen? Is there anyone who can talk to me? Someone you could call and ask?
Look, he said slowly, as if he was waiting for the Gaius to stop him again. There's an antiquarian bookstore in the Uptown Mall in Richland. You might go talk to the man who runs it. He might be able to help you find out more about that stick. Make sure you tell him that I sent you to him, but wait until he's alone in the store.
Thank you.
No, Mercy. Thank you.
He paused. And then, for a moment sounding a bit like the 9-year-old I'd first met, he said,
I'm scared, Mercy. They mean to let him take the fall, don't they?
They were, I said, but I think it might be too late. The police are not accepting his guilt at face value, and we found Z a terrific lawyer. I'm doing a little nosing about in O'Donnell's other doings.
Mercy, he said quietly,
Geez, Mercy, are you setting yourself up against the Grey Lords? You know that's what the blind woman is, right? Sent to make sure they get the outcome they want.
The Fae don't care who did it, I told him. Once it's been established that it was a Fae who killed O'Donnell, they don't care if they get the murderer. They need someone to take the fall quickly, and then they can hunt down the real culprit out of sight of the world.
And even though my father has done everything he can think of to dissuade you, you're not going to back down, he said.
Of course. Of course. He's trying to keep me out of it, I whispered.
There was a short pause. Don't tell me you thought he was really mad at you.
He's calling in his loan, I told him, as a knot of pain slowly unknotted. Z knew what the Fae would do, and he'd been trying to keep me out of danger. How would he put it? She'd better hope I don't get out, because if I got him out, the Grey Lords would be unhappy with me.
Of course he is. My father is brilliant and older than dirt, but he has this unreasoning fear of the Grey Lords. He thinks they can't be stopped. Once he realized how the wind was blowing, he would do his best to keep everyone else out of it.
Tad, stay at school, I told him. There's nothing you can do here except get into trouble. The Grey Lords don't have jurisdiction over me.
He snorted. I'd like to see you tell them that, except that I like you just as you are. Alive.
If you come here, they will kill you. How is that going to help your father? Tear up that ticket, and I'll do my best. I'm not alone. Adam knows what's up.
Tad really respected Adam. As I hoped, it was the right touch. All right, I'll stay here, for now. Let me see if I can give you a little more help, and how far this damned guy-ass Uncle Mike set on me goes.
There was a long pause as he worked through things.
Okay, I think I can talk about Nemani.
Who?
Uncle Mike said the carrion crow, right? And I assume he wasn't talking about the smallish crow that lives in the British Isles, but the carrion crow.
Yes, the three white feathers on her head seem to be important.
It must be Nemani, then.
There was satisfaction in his voice.
This is a good thing?
Very good, he said.
There are some of the Grey Lords who would just as soon kill everyone until the problems go away. Nemani is different.
She doesn't like to kill.
Tad sighed. Sometimes you are so innocent. I don't know of any Fae who doesn't enjoy spilling blood at some level. And Nemani was one of the Morrigan, the battle goddesses of the Celts. One of her jobs was delivering the killing blow to the heroes dying in the aftermath of a battle to end their suffering.
That doesn't sound promising, I muttered.
Tad heard. The thing about the old warriors is that they have a sense of honor, Mercy. Pointless death or wrongful death is an anathema to them.
She won't want to kill your father, I said.
He corrected me gently. She won't want to kill you. I'm afraid that, except to you, my father is an acceptable loss.
I'll see what I can do to change that.
Go get that book, he said, then coughed a bit. Stupid guy-ass.
There was real rage in his voice.
If it costs me my father, I'm going to have a talk with Uncle Mike. Get that book, Mercy, and see if you can't find something that will give you some bargaining room.
You'll stay there?
Until Friday. If nothing breaks by then, I'm coming home.
I almost protested, but said goodbye instead. Z was Tad's father.
I was lucky he agreed to wait until Friday.
The Uptown Mall is a conglomeration of buildings cobbled together into a strip mall. The stores range from a donut bakery to a thrift store, plus bars, restaurants, and even a pet store. The bookstore wasn't hard to find. I'd been there a time or two, but since my reading tastes run more to sleazy paperbacks than collectibles, it wasn't one of my regular haunts. I was able to park in front of the store next to a handicapped space. I thought for a moment it had already closed. It was after 6, and the store looked deserted from the outside. But the door opened easily with a jingle of mellow cowbells.
A minute, someone called from the back.
No trouble, I said. I took in a deep breath to see what my nose could tell me, but there were too many smells to separate much out. Nothing holds smells like paper. I could detect cigarettes and various pipe tobaccos and stale perfume. The man who emerged from the stacks of bookcases was taller than me and somewhere between 35 and 50. He had fine hair that was easing gracefully from gold to gray. His expression was cheerful and shifted smoothly into professional when he saw that I was a stranger.
"What can I help you with?" he asked.
"Tad Adalbertsmeyer, a friend of mine, told me you could help me with a problem I have," I told him, and showed him the stick I was carrying. He took a good look at it and paled, losing the amiable expression.
"Just a moment," he said.
He locked the front door, changing the old-fashioned paper sign to closed and pulling down the shades over the window.
"Who are you?" he asked.
"Mercedes Thompson." He gave me a sharp-eyed look.
"You're not Faye."
I shook my head. "I'm a VW mechanic." Comprehension lit his face.
"You're Z's protege?"
"That's right."
"May I see it?"
he asked, holding out his hand for the stick. I didn't give it to him. "Are you Faye?" His expression went blank and cold, which was an answer in itself, wasn't it?
"The Faye don't consider me one of them," he said in an abrupt voice. "But my mother's grandfather was. I've just enough Faye in me to do a little touch magic."
"Touch magic?"
"You know, I can touch something and have a pretty good idea how old it is and who it belonged to, that kind of thing."
I held up the staff to him. He took it and examined it for a long time. At last he shook his head and gave it back.
"I've never seen it before, though I've heard of it, one of the fairy treasures."
"If you're a sheep farmer, maybe," I said dryly. He laughed.
"That's a one, all right, though sometimes those old things can do unexpected things. Anyway, it's a magic they can't work anymore, enchanting objects permanently, and they hold those things precious."
"What did Tad think you could tell me about it?"
He shook his head. "If you already know the story about it, I suppose you know as much as I do."
"So what did touching it tell you?"
He laughed. "Not a darn thing. My magic only works on mundane things. I just wanted to hold it for a bit."
He paused.
"He told you I could find you information on it?"
He looked me over keenly.
"Now, this wouldn't have any bearing on that trouble his father is in, could it?" "No, of course not."
His eyes smiled slyly.
"Oh, I expect that I know just exactly what Tad wants me to find for you, clever boy. Come back here with me."
He led me to a small alcove where the books were all in locking barristers' bookcases.
"This is where I keep the more valuable stuff, signed books and older oddities."
He pulled up a bench and climbed onto it to unlock the topmost shelf, which was mostly empty, probably because it was difficult to reach. He pulled out a book bound in pale leather and embossed in gold.
"I don't suppose you have $1,400 you'd like to pay for this with?"
I swallowed. "Not at the moment. I might be able to scrape it up in a few days." He shook his head as he handed the book down to me.
"Don't bother. Just take care of it and give it back when you're finished. It's been here for 5 or 6 years. I don't expect that I'll have a buyer for it this week."
I took it gingerly, not being used to handling books that were worth more than my car. Not that that was saying very much. The title was embossed on front and spine. Magic Made.
"I'm loaning this to you," he said slowly,
considering his words carefully,
"because it talks a little about that walking stick."
He paused and added in a pay-attention-to-this-part voice,
"and a few other interesting things."
If the walking stick had been stolen, maybe more things had disappeared, too. I clutched the book tighter.
"Z is a friend of mine."
He locked the bookcase again and then got off the bench and put it back where it had been. Then, in an apparent non sequitur, he said casually,
"You know, of course, that there are things that we are forbidden to discuss. But I know that the story of the walking stick is in there.
You might start with that story.
I believe it is in Chapter 5.
"I understand." He was giving me all the help he could without breaking the rules. He led the way back through the store.
"Take care of that staff."
"I keep trying to give it back," I said. He turned and walked backward a few steps, his eyes on the staff.
Do you now?
Then he gave a small laugh, shook his head, and continued to the front door.
Those old things sometimes have a mind of their own.
He opened the door for me, and I hesitated on the threshold. If he hadn't told me that he was part Fae, I'd have thanked him. But acknowledging a debt to a Fae could have unexpected consequences. Instead, I took out one of the cards that Gabriel had printed up for me and gave it to him. If you ever have trouble with your car, why don't you stop by? I work mostly on German cars, but I can usually make the others purr pretty well, too. He smiled.
I might do that. Good luck.
Samuel was gone when I got back, but he'd left a note to tell me he had gone to work, and there was food in the fridge. I opened it and found a foil-covered glass pan with a couple of enchiladas in it. I ate dinner, fed Medea, then washed my hands and took the book into the living room to read. I hadn't expected a page that said, "This is who killed O'Donnell," but it might have been nice if each page of the 600-page book hadn't been covered with tiny, handwritten words in old, faded ink. At least it was in English. An hour and a half later, I had to stop, because my eyes wouldn't focus anymore. I turned to Chapter 5 and gotten through maybe 10 pages of the impossible text and 3 stories. The first story had been about the walking stick, a little more complete than the story I'd read off the Internet. It also had a detailed description of the stick. The author was obviously Fae, which made it the first book I'd ever knowingly read from a Fae viewpoint. All of Chapter 5 seemed to be about things like the walking stick. Gifts of the Fae. If O'Donnell had stolen the walking stick, maybe he'd stolen other things too. Maybe the murderer had stolen them in return. I took the book to the gun safe in my room and locked it in. It wasn't the best hiding place, but a casual thief was a little less likely to run off with it. I washed dishes and mused about the book. Not so much about the contents, but what Tad had been trying to tell me about it. The man at the bookstore had told me that the Fae treasure things like the walking stick, no matter how useless they are in our modern world. I could see that. For a Fae, having something that held the remnant of magic lost to them was power. And power in the Fae world meant safety. If they had a record of all the fairy magicked items, then the Grey Lords could keep track of them and apportion them as they chose. But the Fae are a secretive people. I just couldn't see them making up a list of their items of power and handing it over. I grew up in Montana, where an old, unregistered rifle was worth a lot more than a new gun whose ownership could be traced. Not that the gun owners in Montana are planning on committing crimes with their unregistered guns. They just don't like the federal government knowing their every move. So what if O'Donnell stole several magic items and no one knew what they were, or maybe what all of them were? Then some Fae figured out it was O'Donnell. Someone who had a nose like mine, or who saw him, or maybe tracked him back to his house. That Fae could have killed O'Donnell to steal for himself the things O'Donnell had taken. Maybe the murderer had timed it so Z would be caught, knowing the Grey Lords would be happy to have a suspect wrapped up in a bow. If I could find the killer and the things O'Donnell had stolen, I could hold those things hostage for Z's acquittal and safety. I could see why a Fae would want the walking stick, but what about O'Donnell? Maybe he hadn't known exactly what it was. He'd had to have known something about it, or else why take it? Maybe he'd intended to sell it back to the Fae. You'd think that anyone who'd been around them for very long would know better than to think you'd survive long selling back stolen items to the Fae. Of course, O'Donnell was dead. Wasn't he? Someone knocked on my door, and I hadn't heard anyone drive up. It might have been one of the werewolves walking over from Adam's house. I took a deep breath, but the door effectively blocked anything my nose might have told me. I opened the door, and Dr. Altman was standing on the porch. The seeing eye dog was gone, and there was no extra car in the driveway. Maybe she'd flown here. "You've come for the walking stick?" I asked. "You're welcome to it." "May I come in?" I hesitated. I was pretty sure the threshold thing only worked on vampires, but if not... She smiled tightly and took a step forward until she was standing on the carpet.
Fine, I said. Come in. I got the old stick and handed it to her.
Why are you doing this? She asked.
I deliberately misunderstood.
Because it's not my stick, and that sheep thing won't do me any good.
She gave me an irritated look.
I don't mean the stick. I mean, why are you pushing your nose into fey business? You are undermining my standing with the police, and that may be dangerous for them in the long run. My job is to keep the humans safe. You don't know what is going on, and you're going to cause more trouble than you can handle.
I laughed. I couldn't help it. You and I both know that Z didn't kill O'Donnell. I just made sure that the police were aware that someone else might be involved. I don't leave my friends out to swing in the wind.
The Grey Lords will not allow someone like you to know so much about us.
The aggressive tension she'd been carrying in her shoulders relaxed, and she strode confidently across my living room and sat in Samuel's big, overstuffed chair. When she spoke again, her voice had a trace of a Celtic lilt.
Z's a cantankerous bastard, and I love him too. Moreover, there are not so many of the Iron Kiss left that we can lightly lose them. At any other time, I would be free to do what I could to save him. But when the werewolves announced themselves to the public, they caused a resurgence of fear that we cannot afford to make worse. An open and shut case, with the police willing to keep mum about the condition of the murder victim, won't cause too much fuss. Z understands that. If you know as much as you think you do, you should know that sometimes sacrifices are necessary for the majority to survive.
Z had offered himself up as a sacrifice. He wanted me to get mad enough I'd leave him to rot, because he knew that otherwise I'd never give up. I'd never agree to leave him as a sacrifice, no matter what the cost to the Fey.
I came here tonight for Z, she told me earnestly, her blind eyes staring through me. Don't make this harder on him than it already is. Don't let this cost you your life, too.
I know who you are, more or less, Namani, I told her.
Then you should know that not many get a warning before I strike.
I know that you prefer justice to slaughter, I told her.
I prefer, she said, that my people survive. If I have to eliminate a few innocents or stupidly obtuse people in the meantime, that will not live long on my conscience.
I didn't say anything. I wouldn't give up on Z, couldn't give up on Z. If I told her that, she'd kill me right now. I could feel her power gathering around her like a spring thunderstorm. Layer upon layer it built as I stared at her. I wouldn't lie, and the truth would get me killed and leave no one to help Z. Just then a car turned into the gravel of the driveway. Samuel's car. I knew then what I could do, but would it be enough? What would it cost?
I know who you are, Namani, I whispered. But you don't know who I am.
You're a walker, she told me. A shapeshifter. Z explained it to me. There aren't many of the native preternatural species left, so you belong nowhere.
Neither fey nor wolf, vampire or anything else. You are all alone.
Her expression didn't change, but I could smell her sorrow, her sympathy. She was alone, too. I don't know if she meant me to understand that, or if she was unaware how much I could glean from her scent.
I don't want to have to kill you.
But I will. I don't think so. Thank goodness, I thought. Thank goodness that I had told everything to Samuel. He wouldn't have to play catch-up. Z told you part of who I am. Maybe because he thought it would make her hesitate to kill me, knowing that I was alone. You're right. I don't know any other people like me, but I'm not alone. Samuel opened the door on cue. His eyes were bloodshot, and he looked tired and grumpy. I could smell the blood and disinfectant on him. He paused with the door open, taking in Dr. Altman's appearance. Dr. Altman, I said pleasantly, may I introduce you to Dr. Samuel Cornick, my roommate? Samuel, I'd like you to meet Dr. Stacy Altman, police consultant, the Carrion Crow. The Fae know her as Namani,
Samuel's eyes narrowed. You're a werewolf, said Namani. Samuel Cornick. There was a pause. The Maroc is Bran Cornick. I kept my gaze on Samuel. I was just explaining to Dr. Altman why it would be inadvisable for them to eliminate me even though I'm sticking my nose in their business. Comprehension lit his eyes, which he narrowed at the Fae.
Killing Mercy would be a mistake, he growled. My Da had Mercy raised in our pack, and he couldn't love Mercy more if she were his daughter. For her, he would declare open war with the Fae, and damned be the consequences. You can call him and ask if you doubt my word.
I'd expected Samuel to defend me, and the Fae could not afford to hurt the son of the Maroc, not unless the stakes were a lot higher. I'd counted on that to keep Samuel safe, or I'd have found some way to keep him out of it. But the Maroc... I'd always thought I was an annoyance, the only one Bran couldn't count on for instant obedience. He'd been protective. Still was, but his protective instinct was one of the things that made him dominant. I thought I was just one more person he had to take care of. But it was as impossible to doubt the truth in Samuel's voice as it was to believe that he'd be mistaken about Bran. I was glad that Samuel was focused on Namani, who had risen to her feet when Samuel began speaking. While I blinked back stupid tears, she leaned on the walking stick and said, "Is that so?"
"Adam Hauptmann, the Columbia Basin Pax Alpha, has named Mercy his mate," continued Samuel grimly.
Namani smiled suddenly, the expression flowing across her face, giving it a delicate beauty I hadn't noticed before. "I like you," she said to me. "You play an underhanded and subtle game, and like Coyote, you shake up the order of the world," she laughed. "Coyote, indeed. Good for you. Good for you. I don't know what else you'll run into, but I'll let the others know what they are dealing with." She tapped the walking stick on the floor twice. Then, almost to herself, she murmured, Perhaps this won't be a disaster, after all." She raised the staff up and touched the top end to her forehead in a salute. Then she took a step forward and disappeared from the reach of any of my senses. Between one moment and the next. Chapter 9. Wednesday night I ate dinner at my favorite Chinese place in Richland, then drove out to Tim's house. Since O'Donnell's killer was almost certainly Fae, I didn't know how much good it would do me to attend a Bright Future meeting, but maybe someone would know something important. I only had until Friday to prove Z innocent, or Tad would be putting his life on the line, too. The more time I had to think about it, though, the more sense it made for Tad to come back. I certainly wasn't getting any nearer to figuring out anything. Tad, being Fae, could go to the reservation and ask questions, if the Grey Lords didn't kill him for his disobedience. Maybe I could persuade Namani that it was in the Fae's best interest that Z's son come home to help me save his father. Maybe. Tim's address was in West Richland, a few miles from Kyle's. It was in a block so new that several houses didn't have lawns yet, and I could see two buildings under construction on the next block over. Half of the front was beige brick, and the rest was adobe, the color of oatmeal. It looked upscale and expensive, but it was missing the touches that made Kyle's house a mansion rather than a house. No stained glass, no marble or oak garage doors. Which meant that it was still several orders of magnitude nicer than my old trailer, even with its new siding. There were four cars parked in the driveway, and a 72 once-red Mustang with a lime-green left fender parked on the street in front. I pulled in behind it, because it's not often I find a car that makes the rabbit look good. As I got out of the car, I waved at the woman who was peering out at me from behind a sheer curtain in the house across the street. She jerked a window shade down. I rang the doorbell and waited for the stocking-footed person who was hopping down a carpeted staircase to open the door. When it opened, I wasn't surprised to see a girl in her late teens or very early 20s. Her footsteps had sounded like a woman. Men tend to clomp, thunder, or, like Adam, move so silently you can barely hear them. She was dressed in a thin t-shirt that sported crossed bones, like a pirate flag, but instead of a human skull, it boasted a faded panda head with X's for eyes. She was a little overweight, but the extra pound suited her, rounding her face and softening her strong features. Under the distinctive aura of Juicy Fruit, I recognized her scent from O'Donnell's house. "I'm Mercy Thompson," I told her. "Tim invited me." She looked me over with sharp eyes and then gave me a welcoming smile.
"I'm Courtney. He said you might be coming. We're not started yet, still waiting for Tim and Austin to get back with goodies. Come on in."
She was one of those women cursed with a little girl's voice. When she was 50, she'd still sound like she was 13. As I followed her up the stairs, I did the polite thing. "I'm sorry to intrude on this meeting. Tim told me that one of your members was just killed."
"Couldn't have happened to a nicer man,"
she said airily, but then stopped on the stair landing.
"All right, that didn't need to be said. Sorry. I don't mean to make you uncomfortable."
I shook my head. "I didn't know him."
"Well, he started our chapter of Bright Future, and he was all right to the guys, but he only had one use for women, and I was getting tired of fighting him off all the time."
Her eyes really focused on me for the first time.
"Hey, Tim said you were Hispanic, but you aren't, are you?"
I shook my head. "My father was an Indian rodeo rider."
"Yeah?"
Her voice was mildly inquiring. She wanted to know more, but didn't want to pry. I was starting to like her. Somewhere under all the bubbles, I was pretty sure she was hiding a sharp brain. "Yeah."
"A rodeo rider? That's pretty cool. Is he still?"
I shook my head. "Nope. He died before I was born. Left my mother a pregnant, unwed teenager. I was raised I'd been spending too much time with Adam's pack and not enough with real people, I thought, as I hastily replaced werewolf with white bread American. Happily, she wasn't a werewolf and didn't sense my lie.
"Wish I was Native American,"
she said a little wistfully as she started back up the stairs.
"Then all the guys would go for me. It's that mysterious Indian thing, you know?"
Not really, but I laughed because she meant me to. "Nothing mysterious about me," she shook her head.
"Maybe not, but if I were an Indian, I'd be mysterious."
She led me into a large room already occupied with five men who were tucked into a circle of chairs in the far corner of the room. They were evidently deep into a very involved conversation because they didn't even look up when we came in. Four of them were young, even younger than Austin and Tim. The fifth looked very university professorish, complete with goatee and brown sport coat. Even with people in it, there was an unused air to the room, as if everything had just come fresh from a furniture store. The walls and Berber carpet were in the same color scheme as the house. I thought of the vivid colors in Kyle's house, and the pair of life-sized Greek-inspired stone statues in the foyer. Kyle called them Dick and Jane, and was quite fond of them, though they'd been commissioned by the house's former owner. One was male, the other female, and both of their faces had a dreamy, romantic expression as they looked up toward heaven, an expression that somehow didn't quite go with the spectacular evidence that the male statue wasn't thinking heavenly thoughts. Kyle dressed Jane's naked body in a short plaid skirt and an orange halter top. Dick generally wore only a hat, and not on his head. At first it was a top hat. But then Warren went to a thrift store and found a knitted ski cap that hung down about 2 feet with a 6-inch tassel on the end. In contrast, Tim's house had no more personality than an apartment, as if he didn't have enough confidence in his taste to make the house his own. Even as little as I had talked to him, I knew there was more to him than beige and brown. I don't know what someone else would think, but to me, his house all but screamed with his desire to fit in. It made me like him more. I know what it's like to not quite fit in. The room might have been uninspired, but it was still nice. Everything was good quality without being excessive. One corner of the room had been set up as an office. There was a dorm-sized fridge next to a well-made but not extravagant oak computer desk. The long wall opposite the door was dominated by a TV large enough to please Samuel with waist-high speakers on either side of it. comfy-looking chairs and a couch, all upholstered with a medium brown microfiber designed to look like suede, were scattered in a manner appropriate to a home theater.
Sarah couldn't make it tonight,
Courtney told me, as if I should know who Sarah was.
I'm glad you did. Otherwise, I'd have been the lone woman out. Hey, guys, this is Mercy Thompson, the woman Tim told us might be coming. You know, the one he met at the music festival last weekend.
Her voice penetrated where our entrance had not, and the men all looked up. Courtney walked me up to them.
This is Mr. Fidale,
she said, indicating the older man. Close up, his face looked younger than his iron-gray hair made him appear. His skin was tanned and healthy, and his eyes were a bright blue with the intensity of a 6-year-old. I didn't remember his scent from O'Donnell's house, but it was obvious that he was comfortable in this group, so he must be a regular attendee.
Aiden, he corrected her kindly.
She laughed and told him,
I just can't do it.
To me, she explained,
he was my econ teacher, and so he's forever enshrined upon my heart as Mr. Fidale.
If I hadn't shaken his hand, I don't know if I would have noticed anything odd about his scent. Though brine is not usually a fragrance I associate with people, he might have had a saltwater aquarium hobby or something. But his grip made my skin buzz with the faint touch of magic. There are things other than fae that carry a feel of magic. Witches, vampires, and a few others. But fae magic has a certain feel to it, and I was willing to bet that Mr. Fidale was as fae as Z, or at least as fae as Tad's bookstore guy. I wondered what he was doing at a Bright Future meeting. It might be that he was here to keep track of what they were doing. Or maybe he was a part breed and didn't even know what he was. A drop of fae blood could account for those young eyes in the older face and for the faintness of magic I felt. Good to meet you, I told him.
So, you know what I do to earn my bread, he said in a gruffly friendly voice. What is it that you do?
I'm a mechanic, I said.
Righteous, declared Courtney. My Mustang's been making odd noises for the last couple of days. Do you think you could take a look at it? I don't have any money right now. Just paid for this semester of school.
I do mostly VWs, I told her, taking a card out of my purse and handing it to her. You'd be better off taking it to a Ford mechanic, but you can bring it by my shop if you want. I can't do it for free. My hourly rates are better than most places, but since I don't work on a lot of Fords, it'll probably take me longer to fix. I heard the front door open. A moment later, Tim and Austin arrived with a case of beer and a couple of white plastic grocery bags filled with chips. They were greeted with cheers and mobbed for food and beer. Tim set his burdens down on a small table next to the door and escaped being buried by foraging young men. He looked at me for a moment without smiling.
I thought you might bring your boyfriend.
He's not my boyfriend anymore, I said, and the relief of that made me smile. Courtney saw my relief and misread it.
Oh, honey, she said. One of those, eh? Better off without them. Here, have a beer.
I shook my head, softening my refusal with a smile. I never learned to like the stuff, and I intended to keep my wits about me to catch any clues that came my way, though my already not high hopes of that had been falling by the minute. I thought I was going to infiltrate an organized hate group, not a bunch of beer-swilling college kids and their teacher. I was willing to swear there wasn't a murdering bastard among them.
How about a Diet Coke? Tim said in a friendly voice. I used to have a 6-pack of ginger ale and another a root beer in the fridge, but I bet these turkeys have already finished them off.
He got a bunch of denying catcalls back that seemed to please him. Good for you, I thought, and quit feeling sorry for him because he didn't have a purple wall or a statue wearing a hat. Find your own group to fit in with. Diet Coke would be great, I told him. Your house is pretty impressive. That pleased him even more than the catcalls had.
I had it built after my parents died. I couldn't stand to stay in that old, empty place alone.
Since Tim stayed to talk, Courtney was actually the one who got the pop for me. She handed it over and then patted Tim on the head.
What Tim isn't telling you is that his parents were rich. They died in a freak car accident a few years back and gave Tim an estate and life insurance that left him set for life.
His face tightened in embarrassment at her rather bold announcement in front of a relative stranger.
I'd rather have had my parents, he said stiffly, though he must have gotten over whatever grief he'd felt, because all he smelled of was irritation.
She laughed.
I knew your father, honey. No one would rather have had him than money. Your mother was a sweetie, though.
He thought about getting mad, then shrugged it off.
Courtney and I are kissing cousins, he told me. It makes her pushy, and I've learned to tolerate her.
She grinned at me and took a long pull of her beer. Over her shoulder, I could see that the others had pulled the chairs around into a loose semicircle and were starting to get settled down with munchies propped on a couple of small, strategically placed tables. Tim took a seat that someone else had moved and motioned to me to sit beside him, while Courtney went to scrounge her own chair. Since it was his house, I'd kind of expected him to take the lead, but it was Austin Summers who stood in front and let out a loud whistle. I wish he'd warned me. My ears were still ringing when he began talking.
Let's get started. Who has business to address?
It only took a very few minutes to discern that Austin was the leader. I'd seen the possibilities of his dominance at the pizza party, but I'd been talking to Tim instead of watching Austin. Here, his role was as established as Adam's was in his pack. Aiden Fidale, the Fae teacher, was either second in line or third behind Courtney. I had a hard time deciding, because so did they. From the uncertainness of their placement, I was pretty sure that O'Donnell had occupied that spot previously. A petty tyrant like O'Donnell wouldn't have accepted Austin's leadership easily. If Austin had been Fae, I'd have put him on the top of my suspect list, but he was more human than I. Tim faded into the background as the meeting continued. Not because he didn't say anything, but because no one listened to him unless his remarks were repeated by either Courtney or Austin. After a while, I started to put some things together from chance remarks. O'Donnell might have started Bright Future in the Tri-Cities, but he hadn't had much luck until he'd found Austin. They had met in a class at the community college a couple of years earlier. O'Donnell was taking advantage of the BFA program that paid for continuing education for the reservation guards. Austin divided his time between Washington State University and CBC and was almost through with a computer degree. Tim, who had no need to find work, was older than most of them.
Tim has a master's in computer science from Washington State, Courtney whispered to me. That's how he met Austin, in a computer class. Tim still takes a couple of classes from CBC or WSU every semester. It keeps him busy.
Austin, Tim, and most of the students had belonged to a college club, which seemed to have had something to do with writing computer games. Mr. Fidale had been the faculty advisor for that club. When Austin got interested in Bright Future, he'd preempted the club. CBC had dissociated itself with the group when it became obvious the nature of their business had changed. But Mr. Fidale had kept the privilege of dropping in occasionally. The first bit of business for Bright Future this meeting was to send a bouquet to O'Donnell's funeral as soon as the time for it was arranged by his family. Tim accepted the assumption that he would pay for the flowers without comment. Business concluded, one young man got up and presented methods to protect you from the Fae. Among them, salt, steel, nails in your shoes, and putting your underwear on inside out. In the question-and-answer session that followed, I finally couldn't keep my mouth shut anymore. You talk as if all the Fae are the same. I know that there are some Fae that can handle iron, and it would seem to me that the Sea Fae, like Selkies, wouldn't have a problem with salt. The presenter, a shy giant of a young man, gave me a smile and answered with far more articulation than he'd managed during his presentation.
You're right, of course. Part of the problem is that we know that some of the stories have been embellished past all recognition, and the Fae aren't exactly jumping up and down to tell us just what kind of Fae are left. The registration process is a joke. O'Donnell, who had access to all the paperwork on the Fae in the reservation, said that he knew for a fact that at least one in three lied when answering what they were. But part of what we're trying to do is sift through the garbage for the gold.
I thought the Fae couldn't lie, I said. He shrugged.
I don't know about that, exactly.
Tim spoke up.
A lot of them made up a Gaelic or German-sounding word and used that to fill out the form. If I said I was a Heberskeeter, I wouldn't be lying, since I just invented the word. The treaties that set up the reservation system didn't allow any questions asked about the way the registration forms were filled out.
By the time the meeting was wrapping up, I was convinced that none of these kids had anything to do with O'Donnell's killing spree and subsequent murder. I'd never attended the meeting of any hate group. Being half Indian and not quite human, I'd have been pretty out of place. But I hadn't been expecting a meeting conducted with all the passion and violence of a chess club. Okay, less passion and violence than a chess club. I even agreed with most of what they said. I might like a few individual Fae, but I knew enough to be afraid. Hard to blame these kids for seeing through the Fae politicians and speech-making. As Tim had told me, all they had to do was read the stories. Tim walked me to my car after the meeting.
"Thanks for coming," he said, opening my door for me. "What did you think?"
I smiled tightly to disguise my dislike of the way he'd grabbed my door before I had. It felt intrusive. Though Samuel and Adam, both products of an earlier era, opened doors for me too, and they didn't bother me. I didn't want to hurt his feelings, though, so all I said was, "I like your friends, and I hope you aren't right about the threat that they present."
"You don't think we're a bunch of overeducated, under-socialized geeks running around yelling, 'The sky is falling'?"
"That sounds like a quote." He smiled a little.
"Directly from the Herald."
"Ouch. And no, I don't." I bent to get in the car and noticed that the walking stick was back, lying across the two front seats. I had to move it so I could sit down. I glanced at Tim after I moved it, but he didn't seem to recognize the stick. Maybe O'Donnell had kept it out of sight during the Bright Future meetings. Maybe it had kept itself out of sight. Nor did Tim seem to see anything odd about a person who had a walking stick in the front seat of their car. People tend to expect VW mechanics to be a little odd.
"Listen," he said, "I've had a little time to brush up on my Arthurian myths, read a little de Troyes and Mallory after we got through talking. I wonder if you'd like to come over for dinner tomorrow."
Tim was a nice man. I wouldn't have to worry about him practicing undue influence via some werewolf mojo or turning control freak on me. He'd never get mad and rip out someone's throat. He wouldn't kill two innocent victims in order to protect me or anyone else from the mistress of the vampires. I hadn't seen Stefan since then, but I often went months without seeing the vampire. For a bare instant, I thought about how nice it would be to go out with a normal person like Tim. Of course, there was a small problem of telling him what I was, and the little fact that I wasn't interested in getting into his bed at all. Mostly, though, I was more than half in love with Adam, no matter how much he scared me. "Sorry, no," I said, shaking my head. "I just got out of one relationship. I'm not about to start another." His smile widened a little and grew pained.
"Funny. Me too. We've been dating for 3 years, and I'd just gone to Seattle to buy a ring. I took her to our favorite restaurant, the ring in my pocket, and she told me she was getting married in 2 weeks to her boss. She was sure I would understand."
I hissed in sympathy. "Ouch."
"She was married in June, so it's been a couple of months, but I don't really feel like getting involved again either."
Evidently tiring of bending down, he crouched beside the car, putting his head just a little below mine. He reached out and touched me on the shoulder. He wore a plain silver ring, the once smooth surface scratched and worn. I wondered what it meant to him, because he didn't seem to be the kind of man who normally wore rings. "So why invite me to dinner?" I asked.
"Because I don't intend to turn into a hermit. In the spirit of, don't let the bastards get you down, why shouldn't we sit down and have a nice meal and a little conversation? No strings, and I don't intend us to end up in bed. Just a conversation. You, me, and Mallory's La Morte d'Arthur."
He gave me a twisted smile.
"As an added bonus, one of the things I've taken a lot of classes in is cooking."
Another evening of arguing about Arthurian writers of the Middle Ages sounded like a lot of fun. I opened my mouth to accept, but stopped without speaking the words. It might be fun, but it wasn't a good idea.
"How about 7:30, he was saying. "I know it's late, but I have a class until 6, and I'd like to have dinner ready when you come."
He stood up and shut my door, giving it a pat before he strolled back to his house. Had I just accepted a date with him? Dazed, I started the rabbit and headed for the highway home. I thought of all the things I should have said. I'd call him as soon as I got home and could look up his number. I'd tell him thanks, but no thanks. My refusal would hurt his feelings. But going might hurt him more. Adam would not like me having dinner with Tim. Not at all. I just passed the exit for the Columbia Center Mall when I realized that Aiden Fadel was behind me. He'd pulled out of Tim's house at the same time as I and about three other people. I'd only noticed him because he was driving the Porsche, a 911 widebody like the ones I'd always lusted after, though I preferred black or red, cliched as that was, to bright yellow. Someone around town drove a purple one that was just mouthwatering. A Buick passed me, and my headlights caught his bumper sticker. Some people are like slinkies. They aren't really good for anything, but they still bring a smile to my face when I push them down a flight of stairs. It made me laugh and broke the odd worry that seeing the Porsche just behind me had caused. Fidel probably lived in Kennewick and was just driving home. But it wasn't long before the nagging feeling that I was being hunted came back to settle on the nerves in the back of my neck. He was still behind me. Fidel was a fae, but Dr. Altman was the fae's hitman, and she knew they couldn't attack me without retaliation. There was no reason for me to be nervous. Calling Adam for help would be overkill. If Z hadn't been in jail and if we'd been on speaking terms, I'd have called him, though. He wouldn't overreact like Adam might. I could call Uncle Mike, assuming that he didn't share Z's reaction and that he would take my phone call. Uncle Mike might know if I was being stupid to let Fidel panic me unnecessarily. I took out my phone and flipped it open, but there was no welcoming light. The screen on the phone was blank. I must have forgotten to charge it. I risked a speeding ticket and took the rabbit up a notch. The speed limit was 55 here, and the police patrolled this stretch of highway often, so most of the traffic was actually traveling only 60 or thereabouts. I did a little weaving and breathed a sigh of relief when Fidel's distinctive headlights slipped out of sight behind a minivan. The highway dropped me off on Canal Street, and I slowed to city speeds. This must be my night to be stupid, I thought. First, I'd accepted an invitation to eat with Tim, or at least I hadn't refused, and then I'd panicked when I saw Fidel's car. Dumb. I knew better than to accept an offer to dinner from Tim. No matter how good the conversation might be, it wasn't worth dealing with Adam about it. I should just have said no right then. Now it was going to be harder. Oddly enough, it wasn't the thought of Adam's temper that dismayed me. Knowing he was going to be angry if I did something usually just encouraged me to do it. I provoked him on a regular basis if I could. There was something about that man when he was all angry and dangerous that got my blood up. Sometimes my survival instincts are not what they should be. If I went to Tim's house for a dinner for two, and whatever Tim had said, dinner alone with a man was a date, Adam would be hurt. Angry was fine, but I didn't want Adam hurt, ever. The Washington street light was red. I stopped next to a semi. His big diesel shook the rabbit as we waited for a flood of non-existent traffic. I passed him as we started up again and glanced in my rearview mirror to make sure he was far enough behind me before I pulled into the right-hand lane in preparation for my turn onto Chemical Drive. He was far enough back, and right next to him was the Porsche, which gleamed like a buttercup in the streetlights. Sudden, unreasoning fear clenched my stomach until I regretted the Diet Coke. That I had no real reason for the fear didn't lessen its impact. The coyote had decided I was ignoring her and insisted that he was a threat. I breathed through my teeth as the reaction settled down to an alert readiness. I'd been willing to believe that we might have the same path home. That little stretch of highway was the fastest way to the eastern half of Kennewick, and you could get to Pasco and Burbank that way too, though the interstate on the other side of the river was faster. But as I turned onto Chemical Drive, which led only to Finley, he followed me. And I'd have noticed if there were a 911 yellow widebody in Finley. He was following me. Instinctively, I reached for the cell phone again, and when I grabbed it out of the passenger seat, it dripped water all over my hand. I realized then that the smell of brine had been getting stronger and stronger for a while. I dropped the useless phone and brought my hand to my mouth. It tasted of swamp.